You mentioned that ballot measure that is attempting to repeal the sanctuary resolutions and Oregon's status as a sanctuary state.
Right.
The ballot measures along these lines about immigration and stuff have frequently passed in Oregon. It's not the same sort of situation as the legislature, which is dominated by Democrats. It's very much the non-urban areas of Oregon have a lot of sway in these ballot measures, and it'll probably be a tight fight.
Right, right. And this is that organization. It's called Oregonians for Immigration Reform, OFEAR. So it's like OFEAR. It's like Oregon Fear. There's something about that that's just deeply disturbing. You know, everybody's got a right to pass laws or try to pass laws that reflect their values. This idea of Oregon Fear really freaks me out, I just have to say.
All right. Well, I've been speaking with Lisa Loving of Unite Oregon and formerly KBOO News Director. Lisa, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
The time is 6 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This Queer Boo Hour is brought to you by Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music. For more information, visit PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. And now, here's two back-to-back episodes of This Way Out.
Here we are again. Here we are again.
Here we are again.
Here we are again.
Here we are again.
Here we are again.
I think it's a historic vote where we can all say we're equal.
I often find myself conflicted whether or not I should try to pass as straight. I talk with less emotion, at a lower pitch, and with a slightly different vocabulary. When I think about it, I'm reminded that this is literally what homophobia is.
For his distinguished contributions to music, Tippett was knighted in 1966 by Queen Elizabeth II.
When the calendar turned in 1991, 100,000 Americans were dead from AIDS, twice as many as had perished in Vietnam.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Chechnya's gay purge engulfs lesbians and trans people. A young man considers the queer in his ear, and and how to survive a plague in many not-so-easy lessons. Those stories and a lot more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the weekend in July 15th, 2017. The horrors get more horrifying by the day in Chechnya, where an effort in the mostly Muslim region of Russia to exterminate LGBTQ people seemingly continues unabated. Hundreds of men suspected of being gay or bisexual have been arrested at work, in their homes, or on the streets since the purge began in April. They're taken to secret gay concentration camps and tortured until authorities are satisfied that they provided the names of all of their friends and acquaintances who could also be gay or bisexual. Six deaths were confirmed by the end of June, either during torture or in so-called honor killings at the hands of shamed fundamentalist Muslim family members. The Russian LGBT network has been helping gay and bisexual men escape the semi-autonomous Russian region since the pogrom began. A spokesperson said this week that lesbians and transgender people, or anyone perceived to be sexually or gender variant, could be targeted in Chechnya too. He said that lesbians are frequent victims of domestic violence as well as honor killings. The buck stops in any part of the Russian Federation with President Vladimir Putin. He assured both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron in separate talks that he'd launch an investigation into the allegations of a gay purge in Chechnya. The Russian LGBT network lamented late last month, however, that Putin's minions have made sure that any such investigation goes nowhere.
In his most chilling comments to date, Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov dismissed questions this week about the gay genocide from a reporter for HBO's Real Sports in a segment about a wrestling league in Chechnya. Stroking his beard and smirking, he told reporter David Scott through an interpreter that, "We don't have those kinds of people here. To purify our blood, if there are any here, take them to Canada," he said. When pushed by Scott about the numerous reports and testimonies by tortured gay survivors, Kadyrov said, "They are devils. They are for sale. They are not people." Clearly unhappy with the line of questioning, he said, "God damn them for what they are accusing us of. They will have to answer to the Almighty for this." A number of officials from the European Union, the UK, and most of the Western world have publicly urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to put a stop to the purge. U.S. President Donald Trump has been noticeably silent.
In better news for LGBTQ people and their allies, Malta's parliament voted almost unanimously on July 12th to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Only one lawmaker voted no among the 67 MPs. Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat fulfilled one of his re-election campaign promises by ushering the marriage equality bill through parliament.
"I think it's a historic vote. It shows that our democracy and our society is maturing, has reached an unprecedented level of maturity, and it's a society where we can all say we're equal."
The tiny, traditionally conservative Roman Catholic island nation has become one of the most progressive in Europe under Muscat's leadership. Malta, home to about 430,000 people, only legally recognized same-gender couples with civil unions in 2014. This year, Malta became the first in Europe to outlaw so-called gay cure therapy. Lawmakers have also enacted pioneering reforms for transgender and intersex people. Government officials in the southern European country predict that same-gender couples could be walking down the aisle in as little as 3 months after several agencies revised documents and forms to conform to the new law's gender-neutral language. German lawmakers have also approved marriage equality legislation, and officials there are also in the process of formalizing procedures and documents. It's now a race to see which country will be the 23rd on the planet and which will be the 24th to host its first wedding of a lesbian or gay couple.
A gay retiree has won a landmark case in Britain's highest court to get equal pension benefits for his husband. The company that now 66-year-old John Walker worked for told him it would not pay out spousal pension benefits to his husband upon his death because his pension plan predated 2005, when Britain first legally recognized same-gender couples. All five judges at the Supreme Court, the nation's highest, overturned a 2015 Court of Appeal ruling against Walker. They concluded that Walker's company was using a legal loophole to deny the marital equality required, somewhat ironically, by the laws of the European Union, which Britain is preparing to leave. The British government has assured concerned activists that there will be no rollback of LGBTQ rights in a post-Brexit Britain. Walker's husband will now be entitled to his annual spousal pension benefits of close to £45,000, about $58,000. Until the High Court's July 12th ruling, it would have only been about £1,000 a year.
The Church of England also advanced equality this week. A motion approved at the denomination's synod in early July called for the government to outlaw the use of so-called gay conversion therapy that claims to make gay people straight. The Archbishop of York, the Most Reverend John Sintamu, is one of the Anglican Church's most senior officials. The world needs to hear us say that LGBT orientation and identity is not a crime, he told the BBC, adding that it's not a sickness, and LGBT orientation and identity is not a sin. The Church of England's governing body also voted to study the creation of special liturgies for transgender people to help them mark their transition. Chris Newland, the vicar of Lancaster Priory Church, said that, "I hope that we can make a powerful statement that we believe trans people are cherished and loved by God who created them." But ministers are not allowed to celebrate the weddings of same-gender couples in their churches. The Church of England's ties to the global Anglican Communion make that problematic. Most of the Communion's increasingly dominant congregations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, known as the Global South, are biblical conservatives that strongly oppose any rights for LGBTQ people, especially marriage equality.
A gay man in China has become the first in his country to win a lawsuit against the practitioners of so-called gay cure therapy. The man, identified only as Yu, endured medications and injections intended to change his sexual orientation for almost 3 weeks in a psychiatric hospital in central China's Henan province. The court ordered the hospital to publish an apology to the man in local newspapers and awarded Yu the equivalent of a few hundred U.S. dollars in compensation. While the decision is considered to be significant, its scope is also narrow. Yu's rights were violated, the court ruled, because his wife and her family had him admitted to the hospital against his will after he had filed for divorce, even though he was not a threat to himself or others.
Elsewhere, the governor of Indonesia's Aceh province vowed this week to put an end to public floggings. Aceh is a semi-autonomous province and governs under Sharia, or Islamic law, while the rest of Indonesia is legally secular. Governor Irawandi Yusuf, however, doesn't want to end the floggings. He now just wants to do them behind closed doors. Indonesian President Joko Widodo expressed concerns in recent meetings with Yusuf about the negative international publicity over the viral video canings in May of a young gay couple with 300 cheering onlookers in Aceh's public square. Widodo is said to be worried about its impact on foreign investments in Indonesia. Pink News reported that a recent study showed anti-LGBTQ bias is costing the world's most populous Muslim nation as much as $12 billion U.S. dollars every year. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other global advocacy groups have called on the Aceh government to end corporal punishment altogether. But officials there launched a special task force earlier this year to ferret out and punish sexual and gender-variant minorities in the province.
About 2,000 police officers prevented confrontations between a few hundred chanting fundamentalist Christian protesters and an estimated 10,000 LGBTQ people and their friends parading with pride under rainy skies in Seoul, South Korea on July 15th. Only 50 people participated in Seoul's first Pride March in 2000.
Several hundred people marched through the streets of Tallinn on July 8th in the first peaceful Pride March in the Estonian capital in 10 years. The annual tradition ended in chaos in 2007 when ultranationalists and religious fundamentalists assaulted several Pride marchers. Organizers said that 1,800 people took part in this year's resurrection. A handful of protesters along the parade route were kept at bay by security forces.
And finally, tens of thousands of revelers celebrated Pride at London's annual parade, also on July 8th. The British Parliament's Palace of Westminster was illuminated in rainbow colors at sunset to commemorate this year's 50th anniversary of passage of the Sexual Offences Act that decriminalized private consensual adult gay sex in the UK on July 27th, 1967. Here in London, Mayor Sadiq Khan wrote on Twitter ahead of the march, "You are free to be who you want to be and love who you want to love."
That's NewsWrap for the week ending July 15th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson, Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others, so if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Coming up later in the program, a thoughtful consideration of the voices we love to hate and hate to love.
I probably do have gay voice. But I'm not ashamed of it. It's just my natural voice, and something I unfortunately have begun to think critically of.
And a recent book that recalls the voices lost during the AIDS years.
In those days, the women's community, what we then call the lesbian and feminist community, was mostly separate from the gay male community. Understandably, gay men and lesbians had our differences.
But first, a historic gay voice with a classical accent.
British composer Sir Michael Tippett. Coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Michael Tippett composed all genres of classical music, including symphonies, string quartets, piano sonatas, and choral works. Ahead of his time, he wrote operas with homoerotic themes. Born in London in 1905, Tippett was initially seduced by the musical works of Beethoven. He graduated from the Royal College of Music and was music director at Morley College in London from 1940 to 1951. During World War II, he was a conscientious objector, which landed him in prison for 3 months. To brighten his time there, he organized and conducted the prison orchestra. For his distinguished contributions to music, Tippett was knighted in 1966 by Queen Elizabeth II. Upon his death in 1998, he was survived by Bill Bowen, his partner of 30 years. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John DeBoer.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
Do I sound black to you? Am I bi-vocal? Keep guessing. While a young queer radio producer from Outcasting wonders whether he has gay voice.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 45 public radio stations affiliated with the Pacifica Radio Network. Hi, I'm Lauren, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Alex shares his experience of the balance between trying to sound heterosexual and trying to sound gay, and the internalized homophobia that comes with this.
I've been working on Outcasting for almost a year now. Of course, it's been thrilling to hear my voice on a polished radio production. But in listening to recordings of myself, I've been forced to confront my voice for the first time, not only my clarity and emphasis, but the actual quality and sound of my voice. To put it bluntly, I ask myself, do I have gay voice? Gay voice is the stereotyped, high-pitched, and emotive voice that television shows give to their gay male characters to separate them from their straight counterparts. It is an extension of the belief that gay men are more feminine than straight men. Often, gay characters are used as comic relief or as a punchline for a cheap laugh. When a character has a clearly identifiable gay voice, it helps the audience understand, but it does this at the expense of being offensive and inaccurate. This small, seemingly insignificant characteristic is a way to ostracize and exclude gay people on a superficial level. Outcasting is an LGBTQ radio program, so many of us are gay. I am too. To some extent, I do have a fear of having a gay voice. It doesn't come from a fear of being outed. I'm out to all my close friends and my family, the people I care about. So, I think that for me, the fear comes from somewhere else. I often find myself conflicted whether or not I should try to pass as straight. It's pretty simple to change your voice. When I try to sound straight, I talk with less emotion, at a lower pitch, and with a slightly different vocabulary. I'm not really sure if this works. When I think about it, I'm reminded that this is literally what homophobia is, a fear of being gay, being perceived as gay. Doing this gives me some security and control, but it doesn't sound like me. It emotionally and spiritually betrays my sense of self. On the other side of the spectrum of gay voiceness, there's the push to sound more gay. When I turn up my colloquialisms and my exclamations, my friends seem to react well. Being a quote-unquote stereotype makes me more recognizable and strangely more relatable. I like when people laugh when I throw down the shade or when I become what is so familiar in media. I think it fulfills my subconscious need for attention, as well as my fear of being forgotten. But I'm not completely sure if people are laughing at me or with me. And again, it just isn't me. So, there's a thin line between the two, both fueled by my social desire to fit in. And to be fair, I probably do have gay voice. But I'm not ashamed of it. It's just my natural voice, and something I unfortunately have begun to think critically of. A more introspective way of considering, do I have gay voice, would be, is my voice an accurate representation of my character? And the answer is clearer to me now. I should try to sound like me, not someone else, not more gay or less gay. I should focus less on my voice and more on what I'm actually saying, because my intention and my words say far more than how I say it.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 45 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Quinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Jerry Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valanche.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens. And you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
A recent book brings an era marked by death back to life for This Way Out queer life and lit commentator Janet Mason, with accompanying music by John Buchino.
There are thousands dying tonight. Some say they chose their own scripts. Blame them, shame them, drugs denied. The sickness, the hate, and the hope side by side by side.
Every now and then comes that rare book that brings your life rushing back to you. How to Survive a Plague, the Inside Story of How Citizens and Science Tamed AIDS by David France, Knopf, 2016, is one such book. The book chronicles the AIDS epidemic from the early 1980s, when the mysterious gay cancer started appearing, to 1995, when hard-won advancements in research and pharmaceuticals made AIDS a virus that people lived with, rather than a disease that people died from. It was an epidemic of massive proportions. As France writes, when the calendar turned to 1991, 100,000 Americans were dead from AIDS, twice as many as had perished in Vietnam. The book chronicles the scientific developments, the entwined politics, and medical breakthroughs in the AIDS epidemic. AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, is a chronic infectious condition that is caused by the underlying human immunodeficiency virus known as HIV. I came out in 1981, and while the devastation France writes about was not my world, it was very close to my experience. In those days, the women's community, what we then called the lesbian and feminist community, was mostly separate from the gay male community. Understandably, gay men and lesbians had our differences. But there was infighting in every group. Rebellion was in the air, and sometimes we took out our hostilities on each other. Still, gay men and lesbians were also allies and friends, something that is reflected in France's writing. I'll always remember the time my partner and I took a bus to Washington, D.C. with the guys from ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, an international activist group that is still in existence, from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. to protest for reproductive rights. The women then went to protest with ACT UP and AIDS-related protests. At that time, many gay men and lesbians were in the closet because we were vilified by society and in danger of losing our employment, family, housings, and ultimately our lives. AIDS activism necessitated coming out of the closet. Hate crimes against us skyrocketed. How to Survive a Plague is told in stories, including the author's own story. This is apt because the gay rights movement was full of stories, and because of the epidemic, most of those stories were cut short. Almost every June, my partner and I would be part of the New York Pride Parade, and every year we would pause for an official moment to honor our dead. The silence was cavernous. This silence extended to entire communities. A gay male friend, amazed when his test came back negative, told me that most of his address book was crossed out. He would walk around Center City, Philadelphia, surrounded by the haunting places where his friends used to live. We were all so young then. When I turned the last page of How to Survive Plague, I concluded that this is a very well-done book about a history that is important in its own right. The plague years also represent an important part of the American experience. An understanding of this history is imperative to the future of the LGBT movement. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
There's a world in a bubble tonight. Some say we sit by as it rips. Silence, sanctions, action guides. The poison, the greed, and the love side by side by side. But the love survives until the balance tips. We wait in shadow. We live what we know. With a prayer on our lips until the balance tips. The pain we pull through.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Wenzel Jones and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Steve Pride, John DeBoer, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Janet Mason contributed program material, with special thanks to Outcasting's Lauren and Alex and executive producer Mark Sofis. Bobby Day and John Buchino performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMUN Astoria, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
I started going to the mosque, and I started, like, you know, reading about Islam and all that. And ironically enough, it was through that experience is when I actually finally started to accept who I am. I had a, like, sexual relationship with also one of the imams. Like, I just met him online. And then I started going to that mosque more often, and then I saw him there. I was like, oh, awkward.
You're here, you fear, we're used to it.
Life is so easy for the straight white male.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Germany's marriage equality law will make October more festive. A privacy case in India's high court could bring sodomy law repeal. And the real life of a gay Canadian Iraqi novelist parallels his fiction. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 22nd, 2017. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier announced on July 21st that he'd signed Germany's marriage equality bill into law. The announcement couldn't have come at a better time. Berlin hosted its annual Christopher Street Day Pride Parade the next day. Germany began offering less-than-equal civil partnerships to gay and lesbian couples in 2001, and despite recent polls showing public support at a record 83%, equality came only after Chancellor Angela Merkel, who personally opposed the legislation, finally allowed her party MPs a free vote. Opponents are asking the notoriously conservative government of the state of Bavaria to challenge the law in Germany's constitutional court, claiming that such radical reform requires a constitutional amendment rather than the simple legislation that passed in Parliament on June 30th by a vote of 393 to 266. Bavaria-based Cardinal Reinhard Marx, who leads the German Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference, said that he would very much welcome a legal challenge by his state.
The measure specifically states that the new law will come into force in Germany on the first day of the third month following the declaration. The delay allows a number of government agencies to revise forms and documents to eliminate references to man and woman, as required by the new law, to make the language gender neutral. So, barring any challenge to the law being accepted by the Constitutional Court, German lesbian and gay couples could be walking down the aisle by early October. Malta's parliament has also passed a marriage equality law that's scheduled to take effect at about the same time. It's now a race to see which European country becomes the 23rd on the planet and which becomes the 24th to host its first legal wedding of a lesbian or gay couple.
India's Supreme Court may review its 2013 decision that upheld the former British colony's antiquated Penal Code Section 377 that outlaws private consensual adult gay sex. but it's in a seemingly unrelated case involving the requirement that all Indian residents use a unique government-assigned 12-digit identity number, which is being challenged in the High Court as a violation of the right to privacy. The NGO LGBTQ and HIV/AIDS advocacy group NAS Foundation, which has been fighting Section 377 for years, has asked the court to overturn that law on privacy grounds. In hearings this week, one of the justices said that if privacy rights are deemed to be fundamental, then the court's 2013 Section 377 ruling fails. He and his colleagues are said to be reviewing Supreme Court rulings in 1954 and 1962, each of which concluded that privacy is not a fundamental right. Under Section 377, carnal intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal is punishable by up to life in prison. A number of efforts in India's parliament in recent years to repeal Section 377 have failed. Its defenders say the law is not a practical problem because it's rarely enforced. Opponents say it fuels homophobia and transphobia by tacitly okaying anti-queer discrimination and abuse.
10 activists were arrested in a Tel Aviv demonstration on July 19th to protest the Israeli government's opposition to same-gender couples being able to adopt children. The government's position came in response to a question from the High Court of Justice, which is considering the issue. Thousands of people rallied against the government stance. Some held signs reading, "We are not second-class citizens." Television anchor Nadav Borenstein, who emceed the rally, said, "Me and my partner went around the entire world to try and be parents, and the country that we're citizens of is refusing to accept that our daughters are ours. We pay taxes like straight people, go to the army like straight people," he added. "So why can't we have kids like straight people?" As the Jerusalem Post noted, the government has changed its stance on the adoptions issue several times. The protest demonstration apparently prompted the government to ask the High Court for more time to again reconsider its position. There's no such thing as civil marriage in Israel. Only religious authorities can marry couples, and no traditional Jewish, Muslim, or Christian cleric will celebrate the wedding of a same-gender couple. Equality activists generally support long-running efforts in Israel to create civil marriage for both heterosexual and same-gender couples.
In this week's news of the ongoing effort in the Russian region of Chechnya to exterminate LGBTQ people, the Kremlin defended last week's inflammatory remarks of the mostly Muslim region's President Ramzan Kadyrov that called gays devils for sale and not people. Kadyrov also said during the interview on HBO to promote the Chechen sports industry that families are justified in killing LGBTQ relatives because of our faith, our mentality, customs, and traditions. Even if it's punishable under the law, he added, we would still condone it. Vladimir Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters this week that, as for Kadyrov's interview, frankly speaking, very often his words are taken out of context, and that nothing out of the ordinary was said there.
Several credible news sources have been documenting the apparent government-ordered genocide that began in Chechnya in April. Hundreds of men suspected of being gay or bisexual have been rounded up and tortured in secret gay concentration camps until they provide Chechen authorities with the names of all of their friends. The Russian LGBT network said last week that any person perceived to be lesbian or trans in Chechnya is likely to also be caught up in the pogrom. At least 6 deaths have been confirmed, some during torture and others in so-called honor killings by shamed fundamentalist Muslim family members.
The Trump administration has finally joined most of the Western world to condemn the purge and to urge Putin, who's the last word on what happens in the Russian Federation, to put a stop to it. French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel have publicly challenged Putin about the situation. Spokeswoman Heather Nauert told reporters this week that the U.S. State Department found Chechen President Kadyrov's remarks very concerning and also upsetting. She claimed that people in the administration have discussed the situation with Russian officials at the highest levels. However, there was no indication that Trump himself challenged Putin on the Chechen purge during his formal and informal talks with the Russian president at the recent G20 summit.
Several transgender people in the U.S. state of North Carolina returned to federal court this week to challenge the measure that purportedly replaced the odious HB2, which forced trans people to use the bathroom or other public facility corresponding to the gender on their birth certificate. It also banned local governments in the state from passing ordinances to protect their LGBTQ citizens from discrimination. Led by lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union, the new filing challenges HB 142, the measure approved earlier this year and hailed by Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and Republican lawmakers as a replacement for HB 2, which cost the state millions of dollars through boycotts by sports associations, entertainers, businesses, and nonprofit groups. However, as critics noted when it was being considered, HB 142 simply puts an expiration date of 2020 on the ban of local ordinances protecting LGBTQ people and prevents the specific passage by local jurisdictions of measures to allow trans people to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. This week's federal court filing contends that the differences between HB 142 and HB 2 are, at best, cosmetic, and that unconstitutional discrimination against LGBTQ people continues in the Tar Heel State.
We have updated numbers for last week's breaking news about the contentious Pride Parade in Seoul, South Korea. Based on initial accounts, we reported that about 10,000 marchers separated from hundreds of chanting fundamentalist Christian opponents by about 2,000 police officers did not let rainy skies dampen their enthusiasm during the July 15th parade. The Korea Herald subsequently reported the crowd to have actually topped 85,000 people, the largest ever to celebrate Pride in the South Korean capital, and it required some 6,000 police officers to successfully keep the peace. Happily, no major clashes were reported.
And finally, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is, at least as of July 22nd, still the Attorney General of the United States. He said he's staying on, despite President Trump's withering criticism of him during a July 18th interview with the New York Times and Washington Post revelations on July 21st about additional previously undisclosed contacts by Trump surrogate Sessions with Russian officials during the 2016 presidential campaign. Late-night TV host Stephen Colbert has his own issues with Sessions, including the Attorney General's recent speech, behind closed doors, to the rabidly anti-queer legal firm Alliance Defending Freedom. They've represented business people who refuse to serve lesbian and gay couples because of their Christian religious beliefs. They've also helped state officials write so-called bathroom bills to prevent trans people from using public facilities that correspond to their gender identity. Colbert came up with a twist on a venerable queer rights slogan this week in the process of roasting the country's top law enforcement official and his right-wing friends.
Earlier this week, Sessions spoke to an anti-LGBT hate group in a closed-door speech. Closed door? Come on, guys, it's 2017. It's okay to come out. Let your hate flag fly. You're here, you fear, we're used to it.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 22nd, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
A straightforward explanation of privilege.
Life is so easy for the straight white man. The gays can't do all the things we can.
Later in the program.
Hayya 'ala
In his Lambda Literary Award-winning debut novel, God in Pink, Hassan Namir tells the story of a young gay Iraqi confronting the war within, between his sexuality and Islam, against the backdrop of the war in his country in 2003. The author, now living in the Canadian province of British Columbia, told a similar story at this month's Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival. But this story is his own.
My name is Hassan Amir. I was born in Iraq in 1987. My whole life growing up, I knew I was different. I knew that I was gay. I think at the age of like 5 or 6, I knew I started having feelings toward like, you know, like people my age, like guys and stuff. I used to wear my sister's dresses growing up, play beauty pageants with them. I never liked sports, never really played any sports. I've always loved art. I loved reading and writing. I knew that when I looked at men, it was just created this like weird butterflies inside me, like growing up. So I was like, but I didn't know what it meant because it didn't really have a label. I didn't know how to put my feelings into words. And ironically enough, when I was in Amman in 2010, my dad's like sister-in-law, like my aunt, my uncle's wife, she said like that she the day I was born that they knew that I was gay, but they didn't like they were just in denial, like they didn't know how like society would accept it, like they just knew and that I was different. So when we moved to Canada, we left Iraq. Left Iraq the day of my birthday, so September 9, 1998. We left Iraq, went to Jordan, and stayed there for about a couple weeks, and then arrived in Canada September 17th, 1998. I'll never forget the date, and I'll never forget when I found out that we were moving to another country. I didn't even know what's Canada. I didn't even know what it's like. I didn't speak any word English. Like I just knew, hi, how are you? Ironically, I learned the word gay at such a young age in middle school because one of my colleagues, like school, like students, they said, oh, you're gay? I didn't know what it meant. So I remember going to like my mom and my aunt and said, what does that word even mean? And my mom right away freaked out. She's like, oh, it's a bad word. Don't say that again. I don't want to hear it. So at that moment, at even such a young age, I started to associate the word gay with negativity. For me, like growing up, I just always like just kept denying myself because my parents would indirectly hint at the fact that being gay is a sign of illness. It's wrong and punishable by God. When I was 16, my dad took me to Tim Hortons all of a sudden. He's like, I want to talk to you to confront you about something. And he said, Hassan, are you G? Like, wouldn't even say the word, like, the whole word. Just couldn't say it. So he just, like, started crying. What about your aunts? What about your uncles? What about your family members, your cousins, all the Iraqi community? What would they say? Because for them, it's all about what other people think. It's about, like, the public image, the idea, like, that, people finding out, oh, my God, it's, like, scandalous. It's haram. It's forbidden, you know? So, like, rather than him empathizing with me and putting himself in my shoes, he chose to, like, feel sorry for me for a bit. But then he was kind of, like, against that idea. He said, you have 2 weeks to find a job and move out. Because I can't accept a gay son. My sister, Rand, who I love so much, I came out to her when I was 12, and she's like, Hassan, tell me something new. She's like, I've always known, and always been. We worked together at McDonald's, and I slept with the manager of McDonald's, and then she found out through another coworker, and that's when I kind of talked to her about it and all that, and it was just like, and it was for her, so for her it was like, oh, I'll accept you for who you are, I love you for who you are. She never once threatened me to tell my parents or anything. She's always been like supportive, trying to like lie for me and hide for things when I go out with a guy and so she's always been like this, the light and support of my life. So my sister said, Hassan, you're not like, you don't have a job right now, you're going to school, just for once, just like go back in the closet again, at least until you find, get yourself with support and all that. She's like, right now, I don't think you're ready to like just move out on your own and all that. Where are you gonna go, you know? I went back in the closet once again. And that's when I then kind of like changed almost 360 degrees. I went through like a religious phase. I thought like by becoming religious that could help me change, because I was just like, well, I just don't want to lose my family. I don't want to lose them. I don't want to, like, what am I supposed to do, you know? So I started going to the mosque, the Ashia Mosque, the Husseiniyah, and I started reading about Islam and all that. And ironically enough, it was through that experience is when I actually finally started to accept who I am, I think, because for me, it was through that experience, like by going to the mosque and like and realizing what it, like, and also like on the side, like I had a like sexual relationship with also the, one of the imams as well, who's go figure. He was like married, had 3-4 daughters and all that, but that's the thing. A lot of these men like live a double life, you know, like they'll get married and their wives don't know anything. In fact, I didn't even know he was like one of the imam of the mosque until after. Like I just met him online, and then after I started going to that mosque more often, and then I saw him there, I was like, oh, awkward. Like that experience, that whole going to the mosque and really opened my eyes. I read the Quran through that experience twice. And then I realized, I was like, people's interpretation is what kind of like sometimes fascinates me, because the language of the Quran is very poetic, very, sometimes there's a lot of vagueness in it, like a lot of open interpretations, a lot of stories. So even like all the stories, like the story of Lut, I've read it a few times, and that's a story that a lot of people say, oh, they use as a source of condemning homosexuality, that this, the idea of like the people of the Lut were having sex with like homosexual sex, and then God sent to destroy them. But then I read more into the story, and then I realized it was like rape of angels, and that's what caused all this. So obviously, like there's more to it, I think. And through that experience of reading the Quran twice and becoming religious is when I actually started to accept who I am as a gay man, I think. It was very interesting. Yeah, and that kind of like then drew the inspiration of writing this book, you know? So after my trip from the Middle East, I definitely hooked up with a lot of guys, and I started becoming more open about myself, and it was just a very beautiful experience. I started to accept myself. I started to like realize that, hey, this is who I am. I can change who I am. I was now it's this. Now I just have to accept it, and become a better person through that experience. So, like my whole life, you know, growing up was difficult because I was trying to confront an identity that I did not want to accept. And all that have changed when on April 9th, 2011. That day, my friend Abbas and I went to another friend's birthday, Mo. It also happened to be this guy's birthday over there. I hadn't met him in person yet, but I did add him on Facebook because I thought he was so hot. It was crazy. And he probably didn't think, he's like, who's this guy adding me, Hassan? Anyways, I told Abbas, my friend, he said, oh, you write a card to Mo, to Tarn, and he'll write a card to Mo. I was like, well, I don't really know Tarn. Like, what am I going to say? So I just wrote a card to him, wishing him a happy birthday. And then when I gave it to him, he was wearing this like gray vest. I'll never forget it, this happy birthday sign right there. And he was just like really buffed up. And then I just gave him the card, and I was just like literally like stood like there. Would you guys believe that my heart like literally stopped beating the moment I saw him? I knew he was the one. I know it sounds cliche. I knew he was the one from day one. I forgot my existence, and I knew I saw my whole life through him, you know? And I just couldn't stop looking at him all night. A couple of days later, I went and told like one of my school friends at SFU, I'm gonna marry this guy. He's like, girl, slow it down. You just met this guy. Like, get to know him first. What if you meet him and you realize he's not the one, you know? So everything about him, like, you know, changed my life. And then he didn't want to be in a relationship at the beginning. He just got out of one, like 5-year relationship with Brian. So for him, it was just too much. And I was just coming off too strong too. So we became friends for a couple months. And then September 9, on my birthday, he came as my official date. And then after that, after my birthday, September 9, on September 10, I just couldn't keep it longer anymore. I really like had strong feelings for him. So I came out to my mom, like I told her I'm gay. She started like almost ripping her clothes, crying hysterically, you know. And then my dad told my sister, if I come home and I see him, I don't know what I'm gonna do to him. So I just left the house. And I called Atar and I was like, I don't know where I'm gonna like live. Can I move in? Like, he lives with his mom and sister, who's now my mom. His mom took me right in. She treated me like her own son from day one. Didn't ask for rent or anything. And was just always been so amazing. So that's why I consider my mom. She's an amazing woman. So, and then we lived together for like 6 months and then got engaged after he proposed. March 9th, 2012 is when we had our engagement. That's when my parents found out about the engagement. I think, like we had a nice, you know, with friends and all that. And one of my friend Ricky posted photos on Facebook, and I guess he had a public profile. So my cousins found out and all that. That's when things kind of went downhill. My dad stopped talking to me. I haven't seen him for 6 years now. That's okay. And then my mom also like was very difficult. I finally saw my mom actually like a couple years ago, and now we see each other like here and there, but it's very like far in between. But we're always like texting each other, talking about like, oh, like watch, because I love watching Arabic shows, so like her and I would be like, you know, gossiping and stuff together on the, through the text and all that, even though we don't see each other that often. But yeah, all my cousins stopped talking to me and everything, and it was just like real bad. But I realized in the end, I'm in love with this guy, and my loves is what keeps me strong. And God is so great and accepting, despite what other people say. And I know God created me this way, and He loves me just the way I am. I found this balance between religion and sexuality. I'm a very proud Muslim, and a lot of people say, "Oh, Islam doesn't accept it." But I think there's a lot of things that people don't see, like that actually Islam is a very accepting and loving religion. I'm not practicing Muslim. I don't pray 5 times a day, but I do inherit all the beautiful things that my religion taught me. And one of the most important things that it taught me is to overlook this radicalism and just accept and love people for who they are, because religion is love for me.
For just one moment, people all over the world could know this love, could know this love, could know this love.
Gay Iraqi-Canadian author Hassan Amir spoke at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in British Columbia. His novel is called God in Pink. The next time somebody asks you why there are no pride parades for straight white men, and people still do ask, the UK pop punk band Rocking Horse Club has this melodic retort.
Life is so easy for the straight white man. A woman can't do all the things we can. Walk in the dark and feel secure. Do the same job but get paid more. What we like and we don't get shamed. We don't get raped and then get blamed. Is it so hard to understand? Life is so easy for the straight white man. The straight white man. 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 Life is so easy for the straight white man. All the things we can. See the police and get left alone. No one ever tells us to go back home. And we're much less likely to go to jail, because the system is biased against black males. The system fails unless you're pale. Life is so easy for the straight white male.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Jessica Andrea and Michael LeBeau, produced by Steve Pride, contributed program material with special thanks to Frida Worden and Wings. Mishari Rashid Alafasi Fred Small and the Rocking Horse Club performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasures to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for your community radio station, KBOO. Bring them to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.